It would be difficult to overemphasize the importance of the philosopher Plotinus, both for the philosophical tradition itself, but also for the development of Christian theology. As you can see from the timeline, which is on this page, Plotinus lives in Alexandria at the same time that the great catechetical school of Christian theology is developing. He's roughly a contemporary of Origen. They study under the same master and knew one another, probably in some sense, although the nature of their relationship continues to be debated by scholars. Plotinus is the founder of Neoplatonism, the tradition that takes Plato's insights and renders them even more, in some ways, rarefied, emphasizing the quest for the one beyond all that is material, beyond all that is created, emphasizing even a separation from or a stepping outside of society to a degree that is not found in Plato himself, who insisted that participation in politics was an essential part of the philosophical training. Plotinus is interested in what we might call meditative techniques and practices, forms of meditation that will lead into a kind of an ecstatic experience of union with the One beyond all creation. And as we'll see, his disciple Porphyry says that this happened to him, to Plotinus, at least four times while Porphyry knew him. Well, this biography by Porphyry, of which we're going to look at selections, is itself also very significant in that it is a model of philosophical biography, which was probably used in part as a kind of a model according to which the life of Antony was written by St. Athanasius. There are phrases and sections of it that are very redolent of what we eventually find the great Bishop of Alexandria describing his great hero, St. Antony, as being. And as we'll see, Antony is in some ways a kind of an important Christian counterpoint to Plotinus, although in many ways he represents a different kind of pole. Antony is not trained. He is not lettered. He is able to debate with philosophers. His piety is able to enables him to get the best of them in some ways, but he is a very different kind of individual whom Athanasius wants to portray as being as balanced and as capable of this kind of ecstatic contemplative experience as Plotinus was, as Plotinus was famed for. Let's look at this biography by Porphyry, and we won't say too much about this man. Porphyry is Plotinus' disciple. He is the one who is responsible for organizing, some would say for distorting, Plotinus' works in the only collection of Plotinus' works which we possess, the Enneads. I've not included in this section, although you can find it in the texts section in the other portion of the course, the downloadable MS Word document form of this biography, Porphyry's description of how he composed the Enneads. In many cases, he seems to have taken things and rearranged contexts in a way that makes them slightly bewildering to read, but he does explain himself and he does allow one to get back to Plotinus's original format. So he's an organizer of Plotinus's writings, and as we'll see, he's also his biographer, and Christians would say in some sense his hagiographer. He wants subsequent generations to know just how pious, just how contemplative, in many senses just how holy Plotinus was, and how he was truly divinely inspired. And of course, his writings do become extremely cherished, and St. Augustine is influenced by Latin translations of Plotinus in his early years as well. So let's take a look at the text of the biography itself. Much is made of this very first sentence, Plotinus seemed ashamed of being in the body. Probably we shouldn't take this as a kind of a sign that he, in a sort of a Gnostic or a Manichaean way, hated his body. He simply regarded it as something of an obstacle, something that had to be trained, something that was secondary, and something that ultimately would be left behind. Because, as we know, for Plotinus, the material world has nothing to do, finally, with one's divine origin or destiny. The creation of the material universe, our material existence, is a kind of fall. For the tradition of Plotinus, creation and what Christians would call fall are effectively the same thing. Plotinus cannot affirm the goodness of creation in the same way that a Christian or a Jew must, but this statement that he's ashamed of being in the body does not mean that he was engaged in a constant warfare against it. However, it does suggest characteristics, and remember, we're looking at this from the perspective of Porphyry's sense of how Plotinus was a spiritual father, a spiritual director. We're looking for hints as to Plotinus' own spiritual journey that would then give us a sense of his approach to how one is supposed to understand one's own movement towards God, towards the One. We see that Porphyry emphasizes in this biography certain characteristic classical virtues. This shame of the body is simply a form of humility, as is his unwillingness, as I've highlighted, to talk about his ancestry, parentage, or birthplace. He isn't even willing, he's reluctant, to allow a portrait to be made of him. And if we drop down to chapter 2, to the paragraph numbered 2, Plotinus is unwilling to make use of some medical remedies that were commonly used in his day. And he also has dietary regimes that include vegetarianism. He's not willing to eat the flesh of animals or use remedies that come from animals. There is a pagan tradition of vegetarianism which dates back to the Pythagoreans and is and resurfaces in a variety of contexts. His abstaining from the use of a bath is also, again, a sign of humility, a sign of an unwillingness to engage in luxury. The bath was seen in Roman times as being a great social context, and in many ways was an opportunity for the rich to flaunt what they had. So what we have in these descriptions is not so much a hatred for or a contempt of the body as an unwillingness to make use of anything that is excessive or that coddles or gives in to bodily needs. And if we drop down several paragraphs to the highlighted text that describes his death, the last words that he said, which Porphyry quotes, although Porphyry wasn't there at the death of Plotinus, "I am striving to give back to the divine in myself, to the divine in the all. I am giving to give back the divine in myself to the divine in the all." Pros to ento panti theon. He is divine within. This is the understanding of Neoplatonism. As we'll see, the soul does not need to be made divine. In a Christian context, it does not need theosis or divinization, because for the Neoplatonist, the soul is already divine. It is returning to the divine from which it has come, from which it, in a very real sense, has fallen. And that is his last utterance, in many ways, a kind of a crystallization of his thought, but we'll see another crystallization in these selections from the Enneads, from Plotinus' own writings, which we will look at after this biography. If we drop down then to number 3, we do catch a glimpse of what Porphyry believes to have been Plotinus's spiritual journey. Plotinus is his spiritual guide, he is his philosophical master, and the journey which he has undertaken, and we might hold in the back of our minds a sense of a kind of a parallel to similar journeys undertaken by, say, St. Anthony in the desert, by St. Augustine as he gradually moves towards his own repentance or his own transformation. Let's note that that Plotinus begins with a love for philosophy, and he studies under Ammonius in Alexandria. This Ammonius was also the teacher of the great Origen of Alexandria. Although Origen was not an uncommon name, there is another Origen mentioned in Porphyry's biography of Plotinus, and there's lots of debate as to whether he is referring to the same Origen whom we know was a contemporary, even a classmate, of Plotinus. So if you see the name Origen in this biography, don't immediately presume that it's the Christian Origen of Alexandria, whom we will be looking at later in the course. So Plotinus goes to Alexandria, is a little disappointed initially, finds Ammonius, and under Ammonius he makes great spiritual progress. He's also introduced to, and we're not quite sure exactly what this means, Persian methods and systems adopted among the Indians. Does this refer to systems or methods of meditation, to practices that have to do with Plotinus's own experience of ecstasy and his recommendation of such methods to others? We really aren't sure, but what I've labeled in these blue bars again are my own commentary. The Persian expedition, Plotinus becomes so interested in these Persian methods, these Indian methods, that he tries to join an expedition that the Emperor Gordian at the time is preparing as a campaign. It's ultimately unsuccessful, and Plotinus is lucky to escape with his life and to return. He returns to Antioch, and eventually he settles in Rome and becomes a teacher. Now, the next stage, stage three, as it were, is teaching, but not writing. Plotinus is not yet writing down his ideas. He will do that, but not quite yet. And so there is a period of, if you will, kind of gestation or formation of these ideas, which occurs in dialogue with his students. And we'll see that dialogue is an important part. Encouraging discussion with the teacher is something that Plotinus particularly did, according to Porphyry. So he's at this stage in his life. If you drop down to the second paragraph, the highlighted text, he encourages his hearers to put questions. And Porphyry, who tends to be a little bit sarcastic and a little bit negative, sometimes even to emphasizing how important his own role is, emphasizes that all of this letting the students talk led to a good deal of wandering and futile talk. Well, I think we can see it. We can appreciate it as being Plotinus's desire that this dialogical model, the compassion of the teacher for the student, should be particularly prominent in his method of teaching. Then the next stage, stage four, is Plotinus begins to write. He begins to write his own treatises, and these will eventually be organized, coordinated, some would say jumbled together, by Porphyry and create the Enneads, the text of Plotinus, which we have available to us today. And there's some description of these treatises towards the end of chapter 5. Then as we drop down to chapter 6, Porphyry describes to some limited extent the various treatises of Plotinus. I've deleted sections in which he describes these treatises in detail and talks about his editorial work. In chapter 7, we note that Plotinus had a large following, not just a small school of students who were training with him, but also people who were well known in society, who came to hear him speak and were even influenced by him to change their way of life. In chapter 7, notice in the first paragraph that we find again Porphyry's rather catty comment about Plotinus's lack of appreciation for those who don't use grammar correctly, and we'll find that he even criticizes Plotinus for that. If you drop down to the highlighted text in the third paragraph of chapter 7, Porphyry tells us about the senator Rogatianus, who is so detached from political ambitions that he gives up his property, dismisses his slaves, renounces every dignity, and eventually adopts a regime of abstinence and abnegation, and his health is restored. So Plotinus is effectively converting the wealthy to a simpler way of life, a way of philosophical reflection, and this is having an effect on their health, a positive effect on their health. So again, it's not hatred of the body, it is a regime that itself is in accordance with nature, which is a very traditional Platonic model. And when we see the life of Antony, we'll see that this is specifically described as a characteristic of Antony when he emerges from the fort. He lives kata phusin. He lives in accordance with nature. So, dropping down to paragraph 8 or chapter 8, Plotinus didn't care to go back to even for a single time reread his own treatises, and so he very much needed an editor, and Porphyry tells us that he served in this capacity. At the end of the selection that I've given you from chapter 8, he was able to live at once within himself, kai heo to amakaitos alois amsunen. He is able to be with both himself, that is to say, he can be profoundly aware of his own spiritual path and at the same time present to and available to others. This is a characteristic that Athanasius describes Antony as having, capable of preaching to others and yet at the same time being able to live with himself and within himself. So this is a kind of description of the Neoplatonist saint, the person who has achieved the goal of the kind of philosophical practice and meditative experience that we'll see described very slightly a little later on. At the end of chapter 9, the highlighted texts, he was gentle, praos. The translation of the Beatitudes is meek sometimes. He was gentle and always at the call of those having the slightest acquaintance with him. He was an arbiter in differences and he never made an enemy. So he was capable of interacting with people in a way that served a social function, even though he didn't hold high political office. Although Porphyry tells us that he did influence one of the emperors to try to found a city based on Platonic models. However, this experiment was not very successful. And then in chapter 10, in the highlighted text about three paragraphs down, there was an attempt to evoke the spirit, the divinity, the being that was responsible for Plotinus. This was a very common belief in antiquity that intelligent, famous people had what we in the Christian tradition might call a guardian angel, what they regarded as a kind of a tutelary spirit, and that this spirit guided and protected the individual, and that if you were a very important person, it might even be one of the lesser deities. Well, Plotinus, we are told by Porphyry, has a real divinity. There is an Egyptian priest who evokes this spirit and discovers that it's not a being of the lower spiritual degree, but a god. So Plotinus is being inspired by some very divine being. And Porphyry even says this, in highlighted in boldface text, Plotinus had for an indwelling spirit a being of the more divine degree, and he kept his own divine spirit unceasingly intent upon that inner presence. So there is attributed to Plotinus by his biographer a quality of inspiration that gives him charismatic gifts, rather like what we saw Bishop Callistos describing in the Charismatic Spiritual Director. In chapter 11, Plotinus has a remarkable penetration into character. He can see into the soul. And dropping down to the next paragraph, he's able to foretell the future of the children that are in his household that have come to him for instruction. And then Porphyry says that he was suicidal at one point. He was considering taking his life. I myself had formed the intention of ending my life. Plotinus discerned my purpose. So here we have the spiritual guide, the pagan philosopher, inspired by a deity who has the ability to see or read the soul and see the terrible purpose of planning a self-murder, of plotting, plotting suicide. And Plotinus discovers this, comes unexpectedly to Porphyry's house, where he'd secluded himself, presumably deeply depressed, and tells him that his decision comes not from reason, but from mere melancholy, from what we would call depression, and he advises Porphyry to leave Rome. And so he does. He lives outside of Rome, and that's the reason he's not there at the time of Plotinus's death. Here's the section to which I was alluding a little earlier on in chapter 12. The emperor Gallienus particularly venerated Plotinus, and Plotinus asked the emperor to rebuild a city to live according to Platonic principles. But again, this wasn't very successful according to Porphyry because of jealousy. So if we drop down to chapter 15, there is a a kind of a contrast between the more licentious kind of philosophers who might be willing to use their tradition as a way of justifying their own evil lusts. In this particular instance, the orator Diophanes is justifying a reading of Alcibiades in Plato's Symposium and Plato's Banquet, and describes that that it might be permissible for a student to submit to the amorous designs of a teacher. And Plotinus is horrified at this. This causes him to want to leave the room, but he remains and instructs Porphyry to write a refutation. So this is a reminder of the fact that in addition to all the other virtues that we've seen Plotinus manifesting, he was chaste to the point of not wanting to hear about any encouragement towards immorality. Section 16, we are reminded of the fact that although Plotinus himself doesn't really have anything to say about Christianity, which would have been fairly well known in this period, Porphyry is very anti-Christian and makes that very clear. He tries to attribute to Plotinus a kind of an anti-Christian zeal, but in fact there isn't really any evidence of this in Plotinus's own writings, that is to say in the Enneads themselves. So dropping down to paragraph 23, Plotinus engages in meditation and thus lifts himself up. So that he lifts himself up to the divine, the God who has neither shape nor form, enthroned above all intellectual principle, above every intellectual sphere. And Porphyry says there was shown to Plotinus this final goal, this skopos, this telos, the goal of being one with God. And he achieves it by the ineffable act, again, by some form of meditation, some kind of contemplative practice. And again, it's made clear by Porphyry that he regards his spiritual master as having been divinely inspired. So what we, again, have in this biography is something that should be very familiar to us from Christian hagiography, and a reminder of the fact that the philosophical world had a tradition of spiritual direction, of spiritual advisement, and a whole series of expectations, including a lifestyle of simplicity, a commitment to reading sacred text. Plotinus would have read Plato's texts as if they were inspired. Clearly, you can tell from Porphyry that he regards Plotinus's texts as divinely inspired as well. And so there are quite a number of parallels which we should hold in mind, have in the back of our minds, as we begin then to look at Christian authors in the next sections of this course.